Global no-no. Republicans told us all last week that U.S. economic woes are due to bad trade deals.
America has lost nearly one-third of its manufacturing jobs since 1997, following the enactment of disastrous trade deals supported by Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Donald Trump cries woe and gloom while economic analysts around the world believe that, in fact, the U.S. economy is the bright spot in the world right now. The referendum on the safety of U.S. assets is a landslide in favor of the U.S., at least for now. Investments are pouring into the U.S., even if U.S. voters don't see it that way. What workers see in their economies and what governments see is the principal gauge of future prosperity, according to our next guest. Can workers make a living wage? How companies compete? If government and workers understand these to be priorities, then a bright future is possible. When workers and governments are completely at odds, as in Brazil, Turkey, and South Africa, rising stars can falter. Ruchir Sharma is head of emerging markets and chief global strategist at Morgan Stanley Investment Management and the author of The Rise and Fall of Nations, Forces of Change in the Post-Crisis World. Since the 2008 crash, he says, politics has become a wedge in the global economic system.
The longer a leader stays in office, the worse it is for a nation. And this is particularly true in developing countries where the institutions tend to be weak. So the leaders can have a big impact on that country. And this is my entire point in that chapter about Putin, about Erdogan. These are leaders that I have met and spent some time with. And it's the classic case that when they first came to office, they were very different. But by year 7, 8, and especially after a decade, they turn into very different creatures. And I think that's what's happened with Erdogan as well. When he first came to office, he was good for Turkey. He was carrying out a lot of economic reforms. And he has really slipped very badly now. And I think that currently I despair for what's happening in Turkey.
In reading this book, I looked back at the Brexit story and I thought to myself, you know, maybe this is all just smoke and mirrors. And that essentially what you describe in this book is that these relationships between Europe and Britain are unassailable. The underpinning relationship between Britain and the rest of Europe must go on.
Yeah, I think so, because I think that there's far too much for Britain to lose. But I think there's a bigger point about Brexit. Brexit is more effect than cause. And what do I mean by that? Every single thing we believed in about the world last decade has been turned on its head. And one of the very big trends, and I think Brexit is a manifestation of that, is that there's a massive anti-establishment wave running through the world today. So we track the popularity ratings of the leaders in the world's 20 largest democracies. They're down 20 percentage points. The fundamental cause here is that this is the weakest economic recovery in post-war history. And I think that that's what's really causing so much angst among voters across the world.
You describe a well-behaved billionaire in your attempt to chart success of an economy by looking at the success of individuals and leaders, corporate leaders, et cetera, in that country. What's a well-behaved billionaire?
Good billionaires are the ones which are respected by a country. If you create wealth in industries such as technology, manufacturing, pharmaceuticals, or stuff where the consumer at large feels that he or she is benefiting from this, those billionaires are well respected. On the other hand, when you have wealth creation taking place by billionaires who are doing it through government connections, by gaming the system in industries which are prone to it, such as real estate, mining, or even oil and gas very often in large parts of the world, you end up getting a very negative reaction. And this is a point I make in the book, that if you look at the United States today, one redeeming quality I still find here is that no matter what we think of Trump, the fact that someone like Trump is being able to make a run for the top office despite being a billionaire, I think still tells you that wealth creation in this country is still sort of respected and not held against you. I travel to other countries, and from Russia to Mexico, there are so many bad billionaires or perceived to be bad that there's no way that they'd be able to make a run for the top office because the people just wouldn't stand for it.
What do you make of the economic discussion that's taking place in the U.S. election? America will be great again. We'll get these jobs back again. We'll change all these trade agreements. Is it talking nonsense? Does it have any basis in reality? Is the conversation, whether it's right or wrong, looking at a world the same way you see it?
Unfortunately not, because I think that what's really happened here is that a strength taken too far has become a weakness. So we had unfettered globalization for the last 3 decades. Obviously, not everyone benefited from it. So we seem to be stuck in this situation, which is that a backlash is taking place and the policy responses that we are taking towards those, which is to turn more inward, to sort of give up on free trade agreements, to close our borders much more to immigration. These are all likely to only worsen the situation.
Why does Brazil seem to be such a basket case in so many ways? It's politically unstable right now. It has enormous natural resources that have not been utilized well. Its agricultural sector is in trouble. Why can't Brazil do better?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because Brazil today is as poor compared to the United States as it was 100 years ago. That's a damning statement that, because standard economic theory says that poor countries should over time close the gap with richer nations. And in Brazil, it's not happened. Now, there are two reasons. Typically, commodity exporting countries do much worse than countries which rely on manufacturing. But there's one really big fundamental problem in Brazil, which is that they prematurely created too large a welfare state. There is no other mainstream emerging market which spends as much on subsidies and welfare as Brazil spends. And that's what chokes off investment elsewhere. And that's why Brazil's taxes are so high and punitive that it's very hard to do business in that country.
Who scares you the most in terms of economic instability on a scale that could produce what we had in the crisis in 2008? Another example of that.
By far, China. This is a nation that I was in awe of growing up because of the incredible economic miracle that they produced for 30 years. But they really lost the plot after the global financial crisis in 2008-2009. They were keen to grow very rapidly in a much slower growth world, and they threw so much money and so much debt at the problem that since then they've not been able to sort of get back to normal. So if you look at the world today, this is really a G2 world, which is it's like about America and it's about China. These are the only two economies which can have global repercussions because of their size. And as far as China is concerned, the fact that it's become so addicted to debt that every time now they have even a minor economic slowdown, they just want to keep throwing more debt at the problem to somehow keep growth going is what scares me the most. Because when a nation takes on too much debt over a short span of time, I demonstrate that nation always runs into trouble in the next 5 years. And China, I think, is at that sort of point now.
Rishir Sharma is head of emerging markets and chief global strategist at Morgan Stanley Investment Management. He's the author of The Rise and Fall of Nations, Forces of Change in the Post-Crisis World. Thanks so much.
Enjoyed being here. Thanks, Joe.